Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Anne-Marie O'Connor, good morning to you in the Cork studio.
Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And Anne-Marie, you're the fashion editor of the Irish Examiner and well known in the fashion industry as a stylist. And I suppose we could call you a maven is probably the word I'm looking for. But that's not why you're here with us today. So look, this story starts, it was September 2020, wasn't it, with a pain in your shoulder?
Yeah. I got a pain in my shoulder, my right shoulder in September 2020. There was a brief respite in COVID restrictions and I was styling a photo shoot. And I came home and I woke up one morning, I think it was about 2 days afterwards, it wasn't immediately, and it was really unusual. I hadn't felt a pain like that before and I thought that perhaps I pulled a muscle or tweaked something carrying heavy bags, which you do on these types of shoots. And I kind of paid no attention to it because I was, you know, there were further mini lockdowns and, you know, respites where I was still styling shoots. And then we had a, you know, proper lockdown come at the end of October. So for the month of November, it got progressively worse. And of course, I was at home on my own because I live on my own. So it was during lockdown. And I had a lot of time to think, OK, I'm not working. Why is this still getting progressively worse? And come November, it was accompanied by a very fine shake in my hand. And the pain was excruciating. I couldn't take on or put on my bra. I remember lying on the bed crying, thinking, I need to take a shower. Should I just shower the bra on and let it dry off like a bikini? So, like, all joking aside, come December around Christmas, my sister had noticed the shake in my hand and said to me, will you promise me that you'll go to the doctor when once restrictions ease? And I said, yeah, of course. Of course, at this stage, I didn't think anything of it. I thought maybe it's a trapped nerve. So come March.
And other people were noticing though, were they?
Yeah. Bear in mind, like, I live on my own, so you don't notice these things when they start accelerating. It's other people. You need that second set of eyes, which was interesting in the progression of the disease because this was during lockdown. And so when we had the respite and I was able to see family, they confirmed kind of the fact that it was progressing. So anyhow,
And was it affecting you at work?
It was, well, not in the early stages. So between March and December, I had three MRIs and they all came back clear. But from around, I'd say the late August, my sister had come to see me and said my hand had started shaking even more. The course had developed from being fine to coarse.
So this was August 21, was it?
No, we're still in, we're in 21 at this stage.
So Anne-Marie, this is a year on.
Yeah, about a year.
And were you freaking out about this?
I kind of wasn't. I'll be honest with you. I was living in kind of hope that it was just, you know, maybe it was an essential tremor or maybe it was just like, again, something that had tweaked in my arm. But around August, I was still going through the MRIs and my sister had said, your hand is now gone from fine to coarse. So the shake was quite aggressive and my shoulder was jerking and shaking. So she said, this is just abnormal. So come December, when my doctor had noticed that, you know, all the MRIs came out clear, she was like, okay, we need to do something about this. Because in addition, this was around the time, of course, very late in the day when I started to get worried. I was doing work for the Examiner for Christmas deadlines and my hands were just shaking and kind of jerking off the keyboard. And I'd refer to them jokingly as willful toddlers. And my handwriting was very cramped and it was illegible. I was writing Christmas cards at the time and I was like, they looked like ransom notes. And I was like, well, they're not going to be sent this year. And it really started to give me pause when I couldn't brush my teeth. I couldn't apply mascara. I couldn't open things like a bag of coffee to make my coffee in the morning. And my doctor said, this has gone beyond, you know, this is quite serious because apart from an operation I had when I was like 8 years old, I had a clear bill of health. The biggest joke in my family was I'd go to the doctor to get a checkup and it would always come out clear. And I said, my doctor is bound to think that I'm some sort of hypochondriac. And I had nary a cold. I didn't even catch COVID. So it was a real land when I was sent to the acute medical unit in CUH. At 9 o'clock that morning, I saw a nurse, then I saw a doctor, a neurologist. And around 4 p.m., I saw the consultant neurologist and I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So up until this stage, that wasn't within my purview. I thought, still was thinking, oh, it's a trapped nerve. They just didn't catch it in the MRI. Never thought it would be Parkinson's disease. Didn't know anything about Parkinson's disease, bar the fact that Michael J. Fox caught it when he was diagnosed with it rather when he was 29, and Muhammad Ali had it as well.
And you're a young woman, presumably you're thinking, ah, no, this doesn't happen.
Exactly.
Like,
I always thought it was the remit of elderly men. You know, you think of the familiar stoop, the shake, the shuffle. You think this is something that happens, you know, in your later stages of life, not to a woman who's in her 40s. And it just didn't sink in. And so my consultant asked me if I wanted to take a seat, and I obliged because I was standing at that stage. And he's like, look, you're very stoic about this. Give it a few days. Come see me. We'll talk about medication options. And he said, you want to bring a friend or a family member with you, because what was said that day went in one ear and out the other. And he said, it will go in one ear and out the other again unless you have someone with you. So it's
important. Do you go into denial, kind of? Yeah, you just don't take it in.
It wasn't so much denial. It was like, I lost my father when he was 37, and I remember my mom telling me how she went into practicality mode. So it's similar to kind of losing a family member in that you think, okay, what are the steps I need to take? It doesn't emotionally, you don't process that to much further down the road, which is what I came to understand. So, you know, we talked about what Parkinson's is. So for those of you who don't know what it is, when you're diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, you've lost about 70 to 80% of the nerve cells that produce a neurotransmitter called dopamine. So dopamine, we normally associate with the reward center in the brain. So we think of, you know, the hit that we get when we scroll on social media or, you know, when we impulse buy. But it's also responsible for movement, speech and coordination. So it has a very important part to play in the body. So when you think that 70 to 80% of those nerve cells have died off by the time you've been diagnosed, like my consultant said to me, you had those symptoms, Anne-Marie, for a year. And you were dealing with that on your own before you got this diagnosis, you know, which in one respect gave me a bit of confidence because I thought, OK, clearly I'm able to handle it. But it almost made me too confident because I, in my naivete, thought, oh, I'm just going to take my medication every day. I can get on with things. And I chose to take medication. Not everybody does, because as my consultant said to me, you're young and vibrant. And for me, I wanted to ring fence those years where I'm capable of making a living, because I know that it is a progressive degenerative disease for which there is no cure. So,
am I right in understanding that medication has a limited lifespan as to how long it'll work for?
It does, in the sense its effect never attenuates. But if you think habituation is your biggest enemy in life, your body will get used to something over time. So you're going to require more of it to have the same effect. So that's my understanding of it. So there's kind of like a few golden years, and I prefer my golden years to be now. Some people decide to stave off medication because there are side effects, Brendan. So the trade-off that I have is, even though my shake is kind of a bit jittery today, most of the times it behaves. So I'm able to make a living because I make a living with my hands. Mm-hmm. But the trade-off is I get something called dyskinesia, which are sporadic involuntary movements that happen on my left shoulder. So it looks a bit like I've been possessed by a malevolent entity. But it has no egregious effect in terms of, like, you know, how I go about my day. So optically, it looks a bit odd, but sure, what harm? So I just see that as the trade-off. off. But the good thing about, not the good thing, I suppose, I have what's known as early onset Parkinson's. Most people, as we said, can develop Parkinson's over 60. You know, you think of it as being a disease that you get when, you know, your golden years, or, you know, when you're a bit more advanced in age. Between 60 and 41, it's said to be early onset, and 40 and 21, young onset, and then under 20, 20 and under, it's juvenile. So there are 10 million people, I believe, in the world that are affected by Parkinson's, and 12,000 of those live in Ireland. And if you think of the split, the gender split is about 60-40-ish, if I'm correct in my
In maths. Favour of more men.
More men. So there are about 3,000 women. And then you think early onset comprises, I think it's about 10% of the population. There's very few of us, you know.
Anne-Marie, like, I agree with your doctor. You're so stoic about this. Like, you, like, I'm just, I suppose most people are thinking that if you were told this, like, it would change everything in terms of your outlook on life and your view on everything, and that you would, there'd be a danger. You get very bitter and at the unfairness of it all. But clearly you're not going down that road.
I'm not going down that road, because I had the biggest land of my life was when I was four and my father died. My father died on Christmas Day. So that was just like a very, and it's always been a conscious decision for me. I know you were just talking about the Christmas lights and things like that, and that's always something I look forward to. And I think it's a very conscious decision we made as a family to always celebrate Christmas, because my father was, you know, mad about Christmas as well. So you can either, you know, say, woe is me, or you can decide to, you know, get ahead of it. For me, as a Parkinson's patient, I think it's really important to be curious about the disease so that you understand it. It's like, you know, lifting up the hood and having a little tinker, you know, deciding to, like, check out what's under, you know, it, underneath the hood in your car, and having a look at the engine and having a little poke about and see what's, you know, just being a bit curious, you know. If you, I suppose that's not the best analogy to use, but for me, I want to know exactly what's happening so that I don't get scared, because there were times when I was like mistaking my symptoms for side effects from the medication. Yeah. So also, it's, I always say to people, it's a multifaceted disease and it requires a multidisciplinary approach. So whether you decide to use medication is up to you, but you might need an occupational therapist, because, or a speech therapist, because it affects some people's ability to speak. You might need a physiotherapist if rigidity and tremor or slowness of movement is, you know, part and parcel of the symptoms that you have. You definitely need your family, and you definitely need your friends, and whatever your community looks like to you, you need that community. Yeah. You need the support systems of people like the Parkinson's Association of Ireland, Early Onset Parkinson's Disease Association. I'm a member of both. I know the Parkinson's Association of Ireland is absolutely incredible. They have a hotline with a dedicated specialist nurse. So if you have any questions that you maybe don't want to, you know, because your neurologists in this country are stretched as it is, so you might just have like an odd question that you want to, you know, field by someone who knows. And like every week she has a Zoom call, and there's a topic that could affect you, like cognitive issues with Parkinson's, or medication that you can't take alongside your Parkinson's medication, you know, things that are a contraindication. And then there's a Q&A with other people who have the disease. And it's just,
I know that it's the least of your problems, but there must be little steps of acceptance all the time in that. Like, getting involved with the Parkinson's Association is not something you ever thought you'd be doing.
No, and it's funny you say that, because it was my consultant who said to me when I met him the second time, you know, there are support groups. And my auntie is a good friend of the head of the Galway chapter of the Parkinson's Association. And she actually said to me, look, you know, what you want to do, Anne-Marie, is get your medication straight, your hydration straight. And, you know, you've got to completely change, you know, you're going to have to change your lifestyle. So get that straight before you go to any support groups. And I never, of course, I was always a late bloomer, but the penny didn't drop. even when she said that. I didn't realize that there were such stringent rules about how you take your medication. Like, for instance, I take my medication at 7 in the morning. I can't eat until 30 to 45 minutes after that. I have to take it with a very large glass of water because it has to bypass your stomach into the gut. If your stomach is filled with food, then it will mistake the tablet for food and absorb it into the stomach, and none of that will get into the gut and cross over to the brain. So, you know, you've got that 3-4 times a day that you have to remember, and you can't eat 2 hours before your next, you know, tablet. So there's...
It's a very regimented...
It's very regimented.
So does this define your life now, day to day?
It does.
Yeah.
And people have said to me, look, Parkinson's won't define your life. And I've corrected people and I said, no, it's part of my life now. In as much as I have brown eyes and I'm 6 foot tall and I work as a writer and I have, you know, four sisters, I also have Parkinson's disease. And that thus determines what I do and how I move through the world. And it's not the end of the world, which is why I was keen to share my experience. But I did so, weirdly enough, of course, the penny dropped months later when I was on TikTok, of all places. But I was interested in seeing the Parkinson's community on TikTok, and I came across a girl's story, and she was talking about things people don't understand about Parkinson's disease. And she said, you know, the medication only staves off the symptoms. It does nothing to cure it. And it just hit me like a hammer, and I just started crying, and I just thought, this is more serious than I anticipated.
Yeah.
But...
Do you think about the future, or does it scare you?
It does scare me. Like I wrote an article for the Irish Examiner, and in it I said, I see the future as an ellipsis. You know, for every heartwarming story that I receive or I come across, I hear ones about DBS, which is deep brain stimulation that involves, it's a neurosurgical procedure that involves drilling through your skull and putting a wire down through towards a little like battery operated remote control that sits adjacent to your collarbone, and that helps stimulate the dopamine in the brain, which scares me to no end. So there's, you know, it's supposed to be an amazing surgery, but it's quite a risky one nonetheless. And then you hear people who lose their ability to emote, Brendan, like, you know, when you can't tell the difference between joy and pain on someone's face, that's really sad. And people who lose their ability to speak or to swallow, you know, it's the worst kind of thief. It robs your dignity and your identity if you let it. But when you're more aware of it, you can be aware of it while not making allowances for its sneaky behavior.
And how are you now in terms of the everyday practicalities of life?
It depends on the day. I was getting my photo taken for the Examiner, and by golly, it took me about a half an hour to put on my earrings and to put on my fake lashes, and I was struggling and the sweat was coming off me. I was like, why did I decide to do this on my own today? I just could have gotten my makeup done. And I put a video on Instagram, and people were sharing, you know, their resources in terms of clip-on earrings and where you can get the best lash extensions. And it sounds like, you know, silly, but to me,
not at all. Yeah,
these are the important things.
Absolutely.
That you know, give you a bit of a pep in your step. And I refuse until the day, you know, until I can't do it anymore, I will still continue to put on my lashes and struggle with my earrings, although I found great clip-on options, so that's great. But I was very keen to share my experience because from what I've learned from sharing it with the Examiner and the incredible feedback that I've gotten, in an age where we live with internet trolls and online feuds, to have such kindness, you know, the kindness of strangers and people who experience the disease sharing their tips with you, and those who have family members thanking you for being open and vulnerable. And I've realized that once shared, any experience is a collective one and no one is alone. So if that can give somebody some sort of consolation in their dark hours when they, wherever they are on their journey, or if they're struggling to tell their employer, you know, it's really important to be transparent from my point of view, because I think someone said it to me, a man who has Parkinson's, this Amory, You need to rely on people. And I'm so used to, I'm single and I'm a freelancer and I'm used to, like, you know, carving my own path and walking alone for, you know, on my own path in life. And I don't rely on my community as much or my family. I'm terrible. I'm a Taurian. So I'm very bullish and stubborn. But it's much to my own behest at times. And he said, you have to rely on people. People want to help. And they're more caring than you give them credit for. And those are true words were ne'er spoken. So I was very keen to like share this with people. And things can't grow in the darkness. So if we can shed a bit of light on this disease, which is so evasive, the human brain is such a mystery anyhow, but we're still every single day there's new information coming out about Parkinson's. When you consider that it's the second most common neurodegenerative condition outside of Alzheimer's, and you go back a few, maybe 10 years ago, Alzheimer's was hush-hush and it was a bit, you know, there was shame and taboo associated with it. Now, you know, we're so familiar with it, and I'm hoping that Parkinson's will go in the same direction, that people will begin to understand it and therefore not fear it.
Anne-Marie O'Connor, I think what you've just done there is so helpful. I can see it to so many people and such a useful thing to do. I don't want to be trite. Nobody's a match for Parkinson's, but I think if Parkinson's ever nearly met its match, it's definitely in you. So many people texting in to say what an amazing person you are, and extraordinary, inspirational, so powerful, give such great hope to people with this disease. And look, I know you're probably not always amazing, but the best of luck on the road ahead, okay? And thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anne-Marie.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.